Welcome to Seeds, a show where we talk with people who are living lives of purpose and doing amazing things that make a positive impact in our world. We take time to listen to them as they reflect on their life journeys and what has shaped them into who they are today and what motivates them to be involved in what they do. Well, kia ora everyone. Welcome along to Seeds Podcast. This is Stephen Moe speaking, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode with Paul McGregor. We had a great conversation about his life, his journey, what's led him to do what he does today. And I really enjoyed the insights that he offered about facilitation. I know you're going to enjoy this, and if you do, why not check out some of the other 380-something episodes in the back catalog of Seeds Podcast. And to find out more, there is a website at theseeds.nz. Now let's get straight into this conversation with Paul. Well, it's a real pleasure to welcome Paul McGregor to the show. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, kia ora, Stephen. It's lovely to be here back in my hometown.
That's amazing. What good timing for you to visit, because we get to sit down together. Because we have one of those relationships where it's been like online, you know, LinkedIn and posts and sharing and stuff like that. But it's always nice to sit down with someone.
It is. Yeah. It is. I love LinkedIn for that. It's like an ongoing conference. That's what I see it as. I know a lot of people go, ugh, when they think about it. But I've met some amazing people through it.
Yeah. I use it all the time. And, you know, the messaging and just you end up connecting with people, tag someone in. And it's like, thank you for tagging me.
Well, just yesterday I found that you were in my hometown and now – well, my new hometown of Nelson, and now here I'm in Christchurch.
That's true. Yeah. Well, what we do on the show is we talk about what you do today, but what we're really trying to do, this is the secret, we're trying to work out why do you do what you do today. So what is it that motivates you? What's led you to do what you do?
Yeah, nice.
And so to help frame it, I find it's really helpful to go back in time right to the early days. So what was life like for you when you were, say, 5 years old?
What a lovely question, and what a surprising question. I've got a daughter who's 5 years old, and so when you asked that question, my mind actually just went straight to my five-year-old daughter.
Right.
And, she comes home from school, and I'm trying to interpret what is going on for you, what is happening in your world. And my parents used to complain a lot because I would come home from school aged five and onwards and I didn't say anything, and they would have to draw the information out of me.
Yeah.
I was very shy. And 5 years old, I would have been a student at Cathedral Grammar.
Okay.
My dad had been a choir boy there, and so my older brother, and so that was where I went.
Right.
I'd say I had a very sheltered upbringing, loving relationship with mum and dad, and
And you had siblings then who were older than you?
Yeah, my older brother, Arthur, and he and I got on really well, and we still do now. So after this, I'm heading out to the movies with him, and he definitely played a big part in my life. Like, I looked up to him for a long time until I got to high school.
Right.
And then all of a sudden I wanted to be absolutely nothing like him. And there were a lot of things that I actually was interested in, but I didn't do because my brother was doing them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that because you were trying to differentiate and be your own sort of, becoming who you were?
That adolescent need to be unique and stand out. Just when I was walking here, I saw a group of adolescents in very baggy clothing, which is the style at the moment. And that's what it was when I was probably 10 years old, when I was starting to get interested in what would I wear and who would I be.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. So that sort of relatively sheltered upbringing then, would you say?
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, sheltered as in... family life was quite insular and safe and secure and happy for me, really. It was a happy childhood of reading lots of books. I was an absolute nerd, escaping to the beach with mum and dad. We used to head over the hill to Chartres Bay, and one of my favourite projects as a kid was dad and a friend Terry, who was a woodworking teacher out in Sumner, building an Optimist together, which is like the smallest, crummiest yacht that you can really build. And so that was going on in our garage, and Dad has been digging out old photos and old stories recently. He retired last year.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I saw a photo of the Optimist and this tiny little me with this hand planer, you know, trying to make this thing something that would sail. Yeah.
And did they get it out on the water? And it,
we did definitely it, did. The yeah. first time we took it out was an absolute disaster. We didn't really know what we were doing. We had this great big party. We invited lots of friends.
Okay.
And we smashed a bottle of Cointreau on the front of it. Cointreau had been my dad's favorite drink. And he was a publican. He owned a pub just around the corner from us now that doesn't exist anymore, that's for sure. It was called the Grenadier, or the Gren for short. And it was a bit of a Christchurch institution in its time. So Cointreau was his favorite drink. So we smashed this bottle of Cointreau, and there's this great big cheer. And in the hustle and bustle to get us out on the water, Dad went, "Oh, you don't need that. No, get rid of it. Off you go." And that was the centerboard of the yacht. And anybody who knows anything about yachts, is it's the centerboard that kind of gives the boat leverage.
Uh-huh.
It's what the boat leans against in order to get its power from the wind. And so our first journey was us floating very aimlessly out to sea, and I think we got rescued by a jet ski coming past. Yeah.
Well, the memories, eh?
Yeah.
And you mentioned you know, grandparents and things. Were they in your life as a young child? Or?
I had one grandparent in my life. So okay. My mum was born in South Africa. My dad went over there for a 3-week holiday and met my mum and got offered a job and ended up staying. And my brother was born over there. So half of my grandparents were over in South Africa. And to me, they were the people who sent us booties, knitted booties, and that was about it, really. Mm. And then my dad's dad, who ran the pub, my dad was always felt quite aggrieved because his dad had gone off to war and had survived, but then came back and was killed by smoke and pubs. So he got lung cancer and died in his 50s.
Right.
And I remember that when my dad turned, I think it was 56, when he turned 56, that was a real milestone for my dad.
Right.
To have reached the age, you know, that his dad only made.
Yeah.
Yeah,
psychologically, there's something there, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
Going into new territory.
Yeah. So that left my nana, who was an epic force. And, yeah, she also helped to run the pub. She was an amazing piano player. So one of the best things we did when she was in her 80s was record her playing the piano. And there's this lovely line that I can remember of her in this sort of sing-song voice. She goes, "I'm just going to play a few songs for my grandchildren." And off she goes. She plonks away on the piano. So she was a big part of our lives. We would stay there a lot. And she had these lolly jars. And that kept us on her good side.
Right. Yeah. Before we started recording, we were talking about the voice and how powerful it is. So I'm really glad that you got a bit of her talking, right?
Like, yeah.
That's a special memory now to be able to have.
And the irony in talking about voice is that I did not use mine as a kid and really hid behind my parents, behind whoever else was around me. And now, you know, a lot of my work almost is a bit of a reaction to that, is helping people to have more of a voice when they don't have one.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I am curious, because you're here in Christchurch because you're emceeing something, right?
Yeah.
Which is not what you'd expect someone who grew up shy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, shy can be a superpower as well.
Mm.
I think we prioritize and we privilege people who talk out a lot in our society, but being shy meant that I stood back and I observed what were other people doing. I'm obsessed with group dynamics, and I'd be more than happy just sitting in a cafe and just watching everything that goes on around me. That is a good day out for me.
Wow. Yeah. And you think that originated from childhood and observing? Like, was that where it started?
Yeah, from being someone at school who didn't talk much, but I was learning a lot and looking around and making sense of things. And because I was quite shy, I think my parents encouraged me into speech and drama. So I did lessons in that all through high school. And so that helped to give me some of the tools to get over my own shyness, for sure. Mm. And, you know, it's those that have kind of filtered into my work now.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this will be interesting to see as a theme as we're talking,
mm-hmm.
what we can trace back to that 5- and 6-year-old version of yourself, you know, and then what you do today. That's always the links that I love making. It's like the person today and you know, what shapes them? What caused them to then do what they do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mum and dad have been organizing all of their old stuff, and some of it is my stuff. And so I recently received a pile of EB5 books, my year 3, my year 4 English books.
Right.
Pretty crack up to read through it and, you know, see these stories and the random stuff that's going on in your head. And I think the other thing that was in there was a certificate for most conscientious year 3 pupil or year 4 pupil or something.
Right.
And I think that became a hangover in adulthood as well, of trying to work too hard at stuff and trying to force stuff. Mm. And thinking that, oh, if I can't get something, if I don't know what to do, if I just work harder at it, it'll come.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's helpful and sometimes it's really not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting, just reflecting as you're talking, I got a chance to interview Neil Iremia the other day. So he's the founder of Black Grace, which is a theater company. Yeah. The Polynesian dance, it's amazing what they do. And so I was talking with him, and from a Polynesian perspective, a Samoan perspective in his case, there's a real sense that time, like, it's not the way we think of it in a Western mm-hmm. conception. So there's things like we walk into the future looking backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about what you're talking about, like the person who you were at mm-hmm. 5 years old, 6 years old, that was still you,
mm-hmm.
but it was that moment in time. And then there's then like alternative pathways of what then happens.
Yeah.
And what were the things, you know, that you were an observant child and you liked looking around and presumably mm-hmm. started noticing things like body language and, you know, how does this teacher interact with the class and stuff? And then and then what that has led to in through what you do today.
Yeah. And it took me a long time to realize that those things that obviously I'd been working on as a kid were maybe things that other people hadn't been working on as a kid. And so things that I might observe or notice, others might not.
Mm.
Like, you know, you go to an event, whether it's, I don't know, a wedding or a concert or a movie, whatever it is, and I love the debrief, the conversation you have afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Where you go, oh, how was that? And what did you think? And everybody always has such a different perspective on it.
Mm.
And I think that's a lot of what I was doing as a kid, was debriefing with myself. what was going on here? Why did that happen? What was going on under the surface?
Yeah.
What made this person do that?
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's move forward a little bit. And you mentioned getting to 10 years old and starting to choose your clothes and things. And as a teenager, what was interesting you? And yeah, what sort of things were captivating who you were?
That's something I haven't thought about for a while. School was an interesting time for me. There were aspects of it that I loved and aspects that I hated. And I'd just say that would be the same for almost everyone. I discovered the things that I loved and I got bullied a lot for those. So that was probably the sort of the good and the bad of it for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved speech and drama. I loved singing. You know, I went to Christ College and we had a choir of 120 boys, which is quite unusual,
mm-hmm.
very unusual.
Yeah.
and it's an amazing experience, that singing together and the spiritual side of school as well. I really enjoyed. I'm not a practicing Christian now,
mm-hmm.
but I actually miss sitting in church and having that quiet time and that singing together.
Mm.
Obviously not enough to go and seek it out for myself right now, but I look back on that fondly. But I got bullied a lot in school, and there just was a lot of bullying at our school. The first day of school, we all got thrown in rubbish bins,
right?
Because that was what the fourth formers had done to the third formers the year before. So
right.
Of course they would do that.
It was a tradition.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. the motto of the school was good traditions well maintained.
Right.
So there was a lot of that. And I being intellectually smart was a blessing and a curse at school as well. A blessing in that the stuff we were doing at school really interested me. I loved studying, I loved learning, and a curse in that I got a lot of slack for it. Yeah.
So you weren't sort of out trying out for the cricket and the rugby team?
I loved that stuff as well. Right. And my auntie, she was a cricket coach, and she wanted me to go to boys' high school because there was great cricketing stuff there, apparently. But it was never the first thing for me. And even now, exercise is a way for my brain to perform better rather than me going, oh, I love exercise and sport and activity and I really want to do it. For me, it's actually a bit of a means to an end.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're coming to the end of your high school period, what was it that was on your horizon? Like, were there career paths or study that you thought, I'm going to go here or there?
Yeah, my favorite subjects at school were English, art, French. And yet I also told myself this story that I should keep my options open. So I also studied physics and chemistry and math just in case I wanted to also be a doctor. And there was very much a narrative at Christ College of doctor good, lawyer good. Those were almost the two. I'm making it a bit more extreme than it was, but a lot of my friends from school, that's certainly the two paths they went down. So I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I thought that was a bit of a failing of me. I now realize that that was just my insatiable curiosity, not wanting to choose. And so I took an easier route, which was also made available to me from the privilege of going to a private school, which was you can go into a gap year overseas. So I saved up the money from summer work to be able to pay for the plane ticket, and off I went. And that was in exchange to another school. So there was myself, there was two Australians and a South African turned up at this school in Woodbridge, Ipswich in England, and we were the hired help, really, the cheap help for sport, for in the drama class, helping out with maths down with the 7-year-olds in the junior school.
And what sort of a school was that? Was it also kind of a private?
Yeah, so it was another, they call them public schools over there.
Yeah, it's confusing.
I've never quite figured that out. But a similar environment of, it was, like a castle, really.
And was it, like, because I've talked to other people who've been involved in teaching in those schools, and it's like, it's a certain segment of society, right, that can afford to send their children to that particular type of school. Did you, I guess you got that sense of class, because it's quite marked in England, isn't it? It's like, if you've got wealth, sometimes there's a lot of wealth.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not as marked in England as it is in South Africa. Right. So for me, that traveling to South Africa as a 7-year-old, where there was a wedding over there, that I now look back on as a really important moment for me.
Tell me about that.
Well, we would go and see family friends who were in large houses on a hill. They owned the entire hill of Cape Town or Durban or wherever it was, and then you would drive down a motorway, and on the left and the right of the motorway are the shanty towns,
right,
where black people lived in tin shacks. And coming from New Zealand, where my relatives would come over and they would take photographs of fences because they just loved the foot high fences that we had, in and around where I lived. And so that wealth disparity in South Africa,
massive contrast,
was such a contrast. So in comparison, England felt a lot more similar to New Zealand.
And that 7-year-old version of you, do you remember noticing that? Like, you were clearly had an observant mind. Did you realize the disparity that you were seeing, or was it?
I think I did.
Yeah.
And I don't think any 7-year-old from New Zealand could travel to South Africa and not feel it. Also the sense of, I mean, we would go to friends' houses and there would be a black woman who was there to be help. You know, that's what they call it, the help.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never encountered anything like that. And it felt really weird to me. But it was normal for my mum's friends and now not normal for my mum.
Right.
So that was an odd experience for her as well.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. What year was that approximately?
Well, mum and dad moved away with my older brother in 1987.
Okay.
As apartheid was,
yeah,
you know, falling apart at the seams. And we probably went back 7 or 8 years after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I've interviewed some South Africans who lived through that 1980s and early 1990s, and they've shared some of their memories and stories. They're now living here. So if I can find them, I'll put links in the show notes so people can click if they're interested. So back to you, and you're in England. Yeah, that gap year, what did it do? Did it crystallize identity, or what was going on in your life?
It's just fun.
Just fun?
Yeah, I mean, having lived a sheltered life, you know, that had continued through high school where I wasn't someone going out partying.
Yeah.
Mum and dad were, you know, very caring for me. And, of course, that just annoyed me as a teenager, right, when I was hitting that age. And so that year was a year of partying. It was a year of working in pubs in the evening, which was amazing because you could have a drink and get paid for it somehow. And then having the holidays from the money that we earned, and you know, we had accommodation that was provided. The money that we earned then was money to go traveling.
Right.
And you know,
what an
adventure that was. Yeah, heading over to Europe and getting a Eurail pass and catching a train around and doing things that I now would look at and go, I really hope my kids don't do that, because we did some stupid things, but they were fun at the time.
And your sense of identity, you know, coming from New Zealand to live in England, did you feel a heightened sense of that, or was it all just fun? You weren't even thinking about that?
I mean, there's a sense of who are you as a New Zealander
that
becomes more marked when you go overseas.
Yeah.
It was the year of the Rugby World Cup, one of the ones where New Zealand lost in the quarterfinals or something. So that was definitely a dent on all New Zealanders' pride that year.
Yeah.
But there was also a sense of, or there were things that happened that gave me a chance to test a different version of who I could be.
Hmm.
Because I'd been very shy, very intellectual at school, and then here was a job or a role where people had different expectations of you, and that were shaped by all the previous people who had come over and been tutors for a year.
Sure.
And that was kind of nice. That was freeing
to
try out some new things.
Yeah. So you were able to step in the shoes of someone with a different approach than you had here.
And also within that, find some of the stuff that really didn't work. I have this memory of the first week. It was hockey season, and we had to get all the balls off the court. And I tried to imitate some of the leadership that I'd seen at school, which was very loud, direct, authoritative, do what I say because I'm the leader. And I must have barked at someone, you know, go get those balls from down the other end. They just told me to get stuffed and ran off.
So you learned what worked and what didn't.
We all do in that time. Mm. Yeah, when you try and imitate someone else and you go, oh, wait, that's not right for me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. It's a theme that comes up in the podcast sometimes, because I think overseas experiences and things when you're young, it does give you a moment to think, who am I? You know, it's a big picture question.
Yeah.
For me, I have an accent, but I actually grew up here, actually in Christchurch. and so it's been a source of, like, what's my identity? Like, my parents are from America, but I grew up here. I have an accent, but this is where I feel home.
Mm.
And for me, it was moving to Japan when I was 21 that made me question, like, what do I believe? You know, like, my parents have sheltered life similar to you, but here I am in Tokyo. I'm like, what do people, they don't know me. No one knows me. They make assumptions. I've got blue eyes and I'm European, therefore you must be fill in the blank, you know. but actually, is that what I am? Who am I? So I'm always curious about that, because I think you're right. It is a chance to reinvent who you are when you move to a new place.
I don't think that really happened for me on my gap year overseas. I think it probably came later.
Yeah. Well, let's keep the talk going. So what happened next? You came back to New Zealand? Or?
Yeah, I came back, and an important moment was working that summer. I worked for Continental Catering, who were a fantastic company to work for. And one of those jobs was working in a kitchen, scrubbing pots out at the airport.
Oh, okay.
For all of the engineers who work on the planes. And the chef there had studied English. I had enrolled to study English at Canterbury University. He did not like his job and was grizzling and groaning. And when I said, oh, I'm off to uni to study English, he said, you should not do that. That's a terrible idea. I studied English, and look at me. Now I'm in this kitchen, and I hate my job. And those weren't his exact words, but that was kind of the theme of what I took from it. So being the impressionable person that I was, I changed my course of study that week and changed to law, but kept the BA in English on the side. So, you know, there's one of those little moments that if that hadn't happened, I could have gone down a very different pathway.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Those conversations that, like, that person probably won't remember that they said that. No. And yet it probably influenced your path. And
I genuinely only worked in that place that one day, because we just get sent around to different shifts at all sorts of different places.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Coincidence. Yeah. Serendipity, maybe. Yeah. So you were, was that here at Canterbury?
I stayed here in Canterbury and lived at home with mum and dad.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends from school had gone Dunedin, Wellington, but I was having too much fun overseas to arrange a hall, and it kind of felt like spending money on something that I didn't need to spend money on.
Yeah.
I think by that stage I'd gotten over my frustration of mum and dad that I definitely had some of as a teenager, just, you know, your typical teenage angst. So, yeah, I was happy to come home. And that first week of uni was also a really nerve-wracking one for me socially, because I had no social structure to sit in.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'd gone to England, there'd been a social structure
to
slot right into. I had a role as this gap tutor. There was a house for me to stay in. There was four of us. But all of a sudden,
it was a natural community. Ooh,
there was a natural community. There was no community for me at UC. I had none of my school friends had gone there, really. Yeah, and if they had, that would have been the year ahead anyway.
Yeah. So what happened?
I remember mum and dad dropping me at the toga party. That was a big thing at UC, was the toga party. I almost didn't go. I sat in the car with mum and dad going, I don't want to go in. I don't know anyone. I was freaking out. And they pushed me out, as good parents do. Had a fine night. Actually, it wasn't that great. I think maybe my toga got stolen off me at some point. But anyway, I was back on the bus heading back out to mum and dad's house on the Orbiter, and some random person taps me on the shoulder. We got chatting. Turns out he lived just around the corner from me. Like me, he knew no one else at UC. So we said, oh, why don't you meet up tomorrow night, and we'll go to the next event together. So he became my best mate. Craig Moore, was just chatting to him yesterday. And
still good friends?
I met my wife through him, and he met his wife through me. Flatted together. definitely still good friends. He's been up in Nelson until recently.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's nice. Interweaving of lives.
Yeah, I mean, we both needed each other at the same time, right? We were both looking around going, jeepers, how are we going to make this work?
Yeah, that's great. What do you appreciate about him?
He's very spontaneous. And sometimes that would show up in a good way, and sometimes in a really annoying way. in the best way, that you'd be sitting there, you know, trying to cram for some exam, and Craig would go, "I'm off to the beach. Who's coming?" And you'd go, "Yeah, of course I'm coming." And so we'd jump in his van, and that was a better option. Off we'd go. And frustratingly spontaneous, when you would walk into your room, you'd try to get in bed and there would be 50 rocks in your bed. And then the next day you'd turn up in your lecture and you'd open your bag and some rocks would fall out because Craig thought that would be funny.
That's great. Well, a shout out to him if he listens to this. And tell me more, like, kind of what happened next in terms of, did you continue studying those topics? Like you said, law and English?
I chose some of my art subjects based on what would be the best calendar for the week. So how could I get Friday off? Or could I also get Thursday off?
Classic strategy,
And because I was interested in every single art subject, that suited me. So I ended up majoring in political science and minoring in music. Which was fun and kind of allowed me to just have a bit more of a creative outlet and then did the law degree as well.
Right.
So it was 5 years at university, which for me was a really happy time. It was a happy space of learning, which great. I'd be more than happy just to listen to podcasts all day, read books all day.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Cram in.
Yeah.
Well, we have similar history then, because I did a law degree at Canterbury I did a BA in political science.
Right.
I did a history one, like, alongside.
Okay, what made you choose political science?
I think when you're doing law, you want something that's a bit different.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, politics, you know, it's interesting.
Not that different,
countries.
Really.
And I did quite a lot in, like, Asian history, you know, like China and Japan. Mm. And I'd lived in Japan, and so it was like ASEAN and all these different political blocs, and Singapore and Taiwan, and it was quite topical, quite interesting. So it was, you know, it's those subjects, it's lots of reading and churning reports and writing and essays, and I was good at that, so kind of naturally fit.
But what I reflect on now is we were also learning a different language, not the language of Japanese or Mandarin, but the language of power. I think that's what you learn in politics. What shifts power, what doesn't, what are these things that you don't see that are shaping our world? That's what I really took from it.
That's an interesting thought. I think you're right. You do end up beyond the leader or the political party, you know, the prime minister or whatever. What was going on at a societal level, and what were the influences that were shaping some bigger questions, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, I loved learning for the first time what is left and right politics. I can still remember the tutorial where we got into that and just demystifying these things that you heard about on the news and you didn't understand, or I didn't understand.
That topic of what shapes society and things, that really fascinates me now, because I think, you know, I like to write papers about things like impact investing and social enterprise and the future of business. And you get these conceptual things and you say things like, a company is a fictional thing.
Yeah.
It does not exist. Mm. We made it up. Mm. Therefore, we can reinvent what they are and what they could be in the future. It's my classic line. I use that all the time. But then how do we reshape it? How do we change it? You know, is it the shootings here, which were awful, led to gun reform, and it happened right away? Whereas in America, there's shootings all the time, and there's no gun reform, and there's this strong lobby against it. And just what is it in a society that allows you, and potentially here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, relatively small population, things could actually change quite quickly if you got the political will to do it. You know? So it's quite interesting topic.
And that cuts both ways too. Things can shift quite quickly for the positive and for the negative. And even when I was hearing you talk there, you know, there's problems that can cause us to make good stuff happen. But then also sometimes it's better to come from a space of possibility and what could be possible that we can't even conceptualize at the moment.
That's good. So you finish your degree. Congratulations. What happens next?
Yahoo. Yeah. Oof. Well, I don't know about you, Stephen, but when you're at law school, there's this narrative of success is corporate law.
Mm-hmm.
Success is being hunted down by a law firm and getting a job there. So I started law school definitely not having that as the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow that became the goal for me.
Mm.
I
was just at the Careers Expo last night for the law school.
And
it's like this massive, you probably remember, it's like booths with all the law firms, all of the different brochures and you know, business cards and little free gifties, pens.
Ooh, who's got the best
all those
gift.
Things. Yeah. But there is this sort of come and work here. Come and we're the best. And it's, you're right. It's hard to express it if you haven't been through that. But I remember that was a big thing. Mm. My first job was at Russell McVeigh in Wellington. So it was that, like, wow, I got a job in it.
The
big firm. And I remember that sort of feeling of like, done it, you know. Because it was in, even then, I graduated in 2001, so it's before you, but it was definitely part of that culture, like, how do you measure success?
So I took that on very strongly and went and worked in a firm one summer in Wellington. My experience was it was dreadfully boring for me. And I think that's probably because they gave you the monkey work. What was more interesting for me was the workplace culture, where you'd have people come back from very stressful court cases, sometimes in tears, and they'd get shuffled into their office. The door would be closed, and the subtext was, stop crying, harden up, shut up, and get back on with your work. Or I have this other memory of getting a cup of tea and the managing partner coming downstairs and letting fly at the two of us who were getting a cup of tea. If there were fewer of you drinking effing cups of tea, maybe we'd be doing better as a effing firm. And,
very welcoming message
there. Well, I know that my experience in that wasn't unique, because later on had flatmates who were lawyers, and I remember one of them came back, and I say came back from work that day, but it was probably several days later, it was probably in the weekend, where at about 10 p.m. at night he'd received an email from one of the partners saying, hey, can you please do this work? No, not please. Can you do this work? It needs to be done by tomorrow morning. This is at 10 p.m. at night, and he replies saying, well, I'm actually working on blah, blah, blah for this partner, so I'm not sure I can do that. The reply was something like, there are 20 non-sleeping hours in a day. Get it done. So that workplace culture did not work for me.
Yeah.
And I guess also I looked ahead at the partners who were, over the Christmas holiday, spending, I think, 2, maybe 3 days on holiday in their lovely batch north of Wellington. But they couldn't enjoy the lovely batch because the work was just overwhelming them. And I looked at that and I went, what's the point of that?
Yeah, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
You raise many, obviously I have a lot of views on this, because the whole legal industry is built on a premise of, how do we judge people? It's billable units.
Yeah.
And if your measure of worth is how many units can you bill, then there's a natural incentivization to work harder and to have even bigger targets, you know? So
regardless of the value that creates.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, the worst case is that things take longer because you can bill more, right? That's kind of the undercurrent as well. And I worry about the industry itself, because if you get given a piece of work and you have a billable target to meet, and you're not actually the best person to do the work, you should delegate it down to the next person, you know. But because you've got these targets, you do it anyway. Like, it's not actually the best for the client. That's one of the things in my team, is we're always talking about, get it to the right person to do it, so that we aren't actually costing more than we need to.
Yeah.
So the client can go and use that money for something else. But it's not a common attitude. So yeah, I hear what you're saying anyway. Because I've had 22 years now working in the legal industry.
Yeah.
So what was for you? What happened next? Where did you end up?
Well, silly me accepted the job anyway at the end of that summer internship because that's success. And what else do you do?
Did you know that it wasn't going to be the right place and you accepted it anyway? Or did you have an optimistic, you did know?
And I look back on myself now and I want to slap that version of me.
Right.
because that is a very thoughtless decision, right, for the law firm who is running a business and is relying on me to turn up a year later and start work.
What drove that then? I'm just curious. Yeah. Like, was it the, we've talked about there's a prestige of getting a job in a big firm. Like, was it, do you think that was a part of it? Or, or was it the, I have somewhere to go rather than not having somewhere?
A bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you asked before about, what I learned about my identity while I was over in England.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I had much of a concept of my identity, even by this stage at the end of university, to be honest.
Right.
What was pivotal for me was I had about a month and a half before that job was going to start, where I'd moved my stuff up to Wellington, moved into the flat with another couple of lawyers, and didn't know what to do. And a friend of mine from university was hosting a race down the Motueka River on a tyre or whatever you could bring that would float down the river. And I thought, oh yeah, I'll pop along to that. That'll be fun. And then I'll continue on down to Christchurch, spend a bit of time with friends and family, and then head back to Wellington and get started in the job. And that person who hosted the River Raft race is now my wife, Ali. So we got together quite soon after, and she was working in the daytime. She would do relief teaching, and in the nighttime she was working in a burger joint, trying to save as much money as she could so she could go traveling. And she was living at her parents' house near Kaiteriteri, which is a beautiful beach. And I almost just moved into her parents' house for about 2 months, and I didn't think that was a strange thing to do, and I thought I was very welcome. And of course, later found out that her parents were going, who is this guy and what is he doing in our house? But I'd known them from earlier in the university times because Ali had been a friend of a friend.
Right, yeah. Right. Is this the friend of the other guy you were talking about?
Yeah. So Ali's curiosity in asking, what are you doing, with your life? And what's this job that you're heading off to do? And obviously my own reluctance came through in my answers.
Sure.
And she must have somehow challenged me and just said, well, why are you doing that?
Right.
You don't have to do that. Why don't you find something else? And that was enough of a push for me to go, geez, what am I doing? I know this doesn't align with my values and what interests me, so I've got to find something else.
Right.
So that happened.
Wow, so that's pretty deep to go, with that relationship, and then she's challenging on the job. So that's...
Yeah, well, not all of us have people who do that for us in our lives, do we?
Yeah.
Where, I facilitate a lot, and in facilitation we talk about holding space. Not many of us have people in our lives who hold space for us to process what we're thinking, what we're feeling out loud. And I think Ali did that for me. Obviously it connected me to her and it pushed me into something different work-wise too.
It's a great outcome.
Yeah.
You're still together. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like where you're going with that as well. I often think one of my hopes for this podcast is that people listening will get challenged in different ways, and one of the things that I think is a challenge for me as well, I'm not pointing at anybody else, is who are the young people in our lives who are at those pivotal moments, and what would it look like if we came alongside them and just took them aside? Like, it could be a nephew or a niece. Like, there's a direct family connection, but it's not like you see them every day. It's not like the parents can't speak in the way that an aunt or an uncle can, or even a younger cousin or someone who's coming up. They're 17, they're 18, they're 19, and you just say to them, hey, do you want to go get dinner sometime?
Yeah.
And what's going on in your world?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. And, you know, like, I think there's almost a responsibility for those of us who've been on the planet a little bit longer to make space for that next generation, particularly if we are related to them and we know them.
Yeah.
Like, what a great gift that could be.
Yeah.
And then also for other people too, you know, just friends of friends. And I'm catching up with someone for coffee soon. It's the daughter of someone I know. Don't know them very well, but they reached out to me and said, my daughter's finishing her law degree. Can she just have a conversation about what it's like to be a lawyer?
Yeah.
I do that all the time because it's a way that I feel like I can contribute in some way to someone else's journey.
Yeah. But,
yeah. Maybe somebody listening, this will resonate.
And we don't have usual or helpful questions for that often to get us into that role. Like, young people will be asked, what do you want to do when you're older? And it feels like there's like, okay, I'm trying to put you in a box, and you kind of go, great, good, do you know or don't you? And I know, I, as someone who did not know what I wanted to do, I felt a lot of pressure around that question. So I just learned to make something up. I'm going to be a lawyer. Easy.
Yeah.
Job done.
Yeah.
And so I could escape the conversation rather than having people who actually would gently hold the conversation for me.
And because the better question is, what brings you joy? Or what is it that resonates with you? Like, because I always think for each of us in our lives, we kind of, it's there. Like, we know what will be the thing. I use the picture of a bell. You know, like, if you're holding a bell, if you're holding it up and you hit it, it rings out clearly for all to hear. You put the same bell on the table, you ring it, you can't hear a thing. And in a way, you, if you'd gone for the corporate lawyer, wow, that's amazing, look at your career, that you probably would have been like the bell silenced. But if you can find what really resonates, then you're going to have much more impact. So,
And it takes more of a scenic tour.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
So that conversations with Ali and, you know, thinking about what will I do, where did you, where did you land?
I did not land.
Right.
Yeah. I'm still up in the air. I'm still flying. I'm still building this thing. And it really was and is still a scenic tour for me. I found a job working for the Ministry of Justice, and that felt more aligned in terms of my values.
Okay.
So,
so you're using your legal background, but in a different way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're using the legal skill set, but not as a lawyer. But that was policy work and operational policy work. What was great about the ministry was there's all sorts of things that they're working on.
Right.
You know, when I never realized how much government does. You know, whenever I think of people who think there's a conspiracy being led by government, I just go, I don't think so, because it would be impossible to hide a conspiracy in those places. And so I worked on courts and tribunals policy. I worked on privacy and information law, sexual abuse support services. There's just all sorts of stuff that goes on that you don't necessarily know, that government is working hard to make our lives better for people. So I loved that aspect of things. And again, found the workplace culture quite challenging. What caught me off guard was how hierarchical it was. I was expecting it to be more egalitarian, less competitive than the legal culture, but it was quite similar. There were 10 layers of hierarchy between me as a junior and the chief executive. More if you added in the minister of the day and what was going on over at Parliament, which could be quite demoralizing at times because you'd work on stuff. Mm. You'd work hard at this policy paper and then you'd send it off and it would get changed and then this person would change it. And by the end of it, it might end up looking like the same thing that you'd produced, but you'd felt like your autonomy had been taken away from you.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, that was the ministry. And I also remember coming back from one, I had about a 2 or 3 month break at one stage and came back. I thought I was on the wrong floor because 3 people had left in that stage. So wow. We had a really high turnover rate as well and really low disengagement, or really high disengagement rate.
Mm.
I think about 80% were disengaged from the job, which made for a kind of a flat working environment.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so at some point, did you realize you wanted to do something else, or what was there a moment?
I felt trapped, to be honest.
Yeah.
I had this narrative in my head of, well, you've worked hard to get this law degree. You have given up that at the last minute, so you better stick the path with this thing. Otherwise, people are going to think you're really unreliable and unemployable. So you better just stick at it. And this is it. This is your job. And just suck it up and do it.
Mm.
So again, that kind of conscientiousness that I'd had right back from when I was a child came through. And I stayed in that for much longer than I really should have. Because I knew for quite a while that I wasn't enjoying it. And I probably wasn't doing my best work either. I was doing good enough, but it wasn't my best.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So was there a moment or did Ali help? Maybe was there something that happened that you thought it's time to do something new?
Yeah, the prompt for me, I was always looking around at other things that might create a new pathway for me. Mm-hmm. One of the most impactful thing was signing up for a youth systems leadership program.
Okay.
I didn't really know what that was, but obviously I read the website and I went, this sounds like something I need. So I signed up. It was with an organization called Lifehack, which was started as part of Prime Minister John Key's youth mental health project.
Okay.
And the kaupapa, the focus of that organization was, how can we use technology to improve youth mental health and well-being? So they got about 35 people from all around the country together, and there was a 3-month-long program with 3 5-day-long events in this retreat center in Otaki, north of Wellington. I remember driving out and not really knowing what I was in for. Turning up, we had these warm welcomes. It was in the bush. It was a beautiful place.
Mm.
They got us into this big circle in the main rooms, welcomed us. There was a mihi whakatau, which I didn't know what that was. And then it was, right, we're going to go around the room and everybody's going to introduce themselves. And they passed to the first person, who was a man called Alistair Thompson. He was probably one of the older people there. He was in his 50s, I'd say, at that stage. And he was the founder of Scoop Media. So he was, you know, a legitimate person who'd started a successful business, and he spoke for about 15 to 20 minutes to introduce himself. Wow. And I was sitting there going, oh, what have I got myself in for? Yeah. What am I going to say? And I haven't done anything worth talking about. You know, that was what was going on in my head, but also I later found out everybody else's head. So that program was a real turning point for me, and part of the reason for that was the diversity of the people in the room as well, in terms of age, background, ethnicity, life experiences. It was all there on show, and was just that exposed me to people who I hadn't spent time with.
Mm.
And we were allowed to have conversations that I hadn't been able to have as well. Mm. And to ask questions that I maybe hadn't felt safe to ask before as well.
Mm. So it kind of exposed you to a different way of thinking.
Yeah, or that there were hundreds of different ways of thinking, actually.
Really, yeah. Diverse group of people.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. And so were you finishing up your Ministry of Justice role?
So I was doing both. Okay. This was, the ministry was amazing. They paid for me to go on that.
Wow.
And supported me with the time off.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what the program was also how can you have the some of the skill sets that people were sharing and teaching were to be relevant back in the workplace. We were learning about design thinking, technology, well-being, science, mātauranga Māori. So then I'd go back to the ministry and then try and use this stuff that I was learning, these new ways of thinking and talking and being, and that was very uncomfortable.
Right.
It did not work because I had had this transformational experience, but nobody else in the ministry had. And I did not have the skills to, or the mandate to take other people through the kind of experience that I'd been through.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just felt like I was smashing my head against that brick wall.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So I'd love to find out more, like, what happened next after the ministry. Because, yeah, I know, like, for example, you've done a podcast yourself.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, tell us what has been occupying your time more recently.
So I'll speed through really quickly a couple of things that were also pivotal. After leaving the ministry, I ended up working for Lifehack, and so learned a lot of the skills that they had around how to bring people together.
Mm-hmm.
And that introduced me to a skill set of facilitation. And I'd never heard that word before that program.
Mm-hmm.
And it fascinated me. So that kind of became my central point of investigation in terms of career. I'd never had anything before where I'd gone, oh, that, I want to explore that, right, and only that.
Yeah,
it was the first time for me. And why it interested me, it was the art and science of group dynamics
mm-hmm.
that I hadn't realized I'd been paying attention to when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And now here was some really smart people going, actually, this is a thing.
Yeah.
And here's what you think about it. Here's how you do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So this is the link back to the 5 and 6 year old you, you know, observing things. Tell us more about facilitation. Like, what are we talking about when you use that term?
I would define it as guiding a group through a process to achieve an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So that role of being a guide is, you mentioned before, being alongside a young person in a conversation, helping them to uncover what they might be their joy that could fuel their career.
Mm-hmm.
So a facilitator is alongside a group. So yeah, you might stand at the front of the room and say, hey, everyone, this is what we're here for, and this is what we're going to do. But your role is not to be this sage on the stage who knows it all, but to be this guide on the side who's saying, here's some stuff that we could do to progress the important things you're working on.
Mm.
And it shows up in lots of places. Like, you're facilitating me right now through this conversation. It shows up in meetings and conferences and events, all these points where humans come together and we gather. And through our conversation, we progress whatever we're working on. Yeah,
I really like the term because, for example, tonight, actually, I'm going down to Queenstown to do facilitating of an Institute of Directors course.
Yeah.
And so I'll come in. There'll be about 25 people in the room. They're each seated at different tables, about 6 to each table. So there's about 5 tables or so. And I, one of the first things I say, I'm kind of setting the ground rules, which I'm really keen to hear from you on. I'll say something along the lines of, because it's a 4-hour block on legal duties and risks and responsibilities of being a director. So it's quite a lot of content there.
Yeah.
But one of the things I'll say is, I'm not here to be a lecturer.
Mm.
I'm not going to tell you what the law says. I'm here to be a facilitator in that I want to hear from you and I want to help answer questions and take us through the journey of getting somewhere in 4 hours. And I always think that's really helpful to say at the start, because otherwise if you stand up and you say, I'm Stephen, I'm a lawyer, I'm here to tell you about legal duties, it's like, oh, I'm back at university.
Yeah.
This is the lecture. So can you just... Yeah, maybe unpack that. Like, what are some of the things that you need to do if you are facilitating a group? How do you get people to realize that you're doing that?
Well, it starts even before you're in the room together. I call that priming. Like, if you're painting your house, you put on your primer layer.
Yeah.
And so I'd say you're probably emailing people beforehand and letting them know what to expect and what kind of event this is going to be. So when they're turning up, they're expecting that it's going to be conversational rather than a conversion where you go, hey, I'm the expert and I know everything and I'm going to download it onto you. And then you use that word framing. So right at the start of being together, how do you set how do you create a new world that you're going to inhabit for that 4 hours?
Mm-hmm.
Because you could inhabit that world however you like. You could create whatever world you like. But people also do come along with their own the way they've been trained to be in groups.
Yeah,
which is often you sit, you consume,
yeah.
and someone else tells you the answer.
Yeah. One of the things that I find helpful, I'm keen on your thoughts, is at the very beginning, after I've introduced myself and established the credibility of why I'm standing there in front of them.
Yeah.
So I tell them my legal background, then I tell them I'm a director too. You know, like I'm one of you.
Yeah.
Once I've set that scene, one of the questions I'll say to them is, turn to the person next to you, so get them actively talking.
Yeah.
What do you want as an outcome of this session?
Yeah.
And I'm not after 50 things, just what are some bullet points? You've got 2 minutes, talk to each other, and then I'll go around and say, okay, what were some of the themes that have come out? Like, I want to learn about liability of being a director. Okay, let's write that on the whiteboard.
Yeah.
All right, anything else? I want to understand about insurance. Okay, let's write that on the whiteboard. And I find that's really helpful.
Yeah.
Because then at the end of the session, I usually turn to it and say, okay, did we cover everything that you wanted? And all of a sudden, it's like, yep, we talked about that. We talked about that. We talked about that. And everyone feels, I guess it's like a closure, you know, like, here's what we want to talk about. And we did it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You're also reducing the pressure on yourself.
Yeah.
So you don't have to take all the responsibility for it being a good experience.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, what you're doing is you're saying you take responsibility because you have to figure out what you want from this. And if you don't know, well, you can't come out at the end and say this was a waste of time because you didn't know what you wanted from it anyway.
Yeah. That's good. Any other tips for people who are facilitating? I like that idea of framing things and getting them ready as well.
Yeah. I just reflect back what you did and point out what's helpful in it, which is that mixing up of the ways that people interact. When I boil down most of my advice, it comes down to the idea of contrast, which is if you mix things up, then it'll be more interesting, it'll be more engaging, and people will take more from it because there's so many different ways that people like to learn. There's so many different ways that people like to exist together. And a lot of our interactions are quite one-dimensional.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
one of the things I usually do after about 20 minutes, 30 minutes, is I say, okay, everybody stand up now. And I want you to, if you feel like it's stretched, I want you to go around to the side of the room.
Yeah.
Let's keep going, but you're in a different position.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, just kind of recharges the energy of the room rather than I'm just sitting here. And that, you know.
I mean, there's so much scientific evidence now as well that is codifying what indigenous communities have known about groups for centuries. And yeah, that's one of them, right? Like you think of dance and music, all the things that happened around the campfire back in our ancestors' days, and we've lost touch with some of that. So if we can actually bring some of that power into our work, we're going to make more progress on the things that are hardest.
If you got, I'm just curious about, have you got any tips? Like, how do we get groups to be willing to go a bit deeper than the surface? It's a beautiful sunny day, isn't it? Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Like, how do we do that? I've got some thoughts, but I'm curious, how do you invite people to journey to a deeper place?
Yeah. There's so many different ways. I mean, you mentioned guidelines before, so that can help. But I think it's all, one of my favorite things is what's called disassociation, where instead of having a conversation about yourself, you put an object or another person in between, and then you talk about them. And that allows people to get more personal faster because they don't feel like they're disclosing as much about themselves. So an example might be I will put 50 images that I've just printed out on the floor, and I'll say, I invite you to choose an image that speaks to why you've come to this conference today.
Sure.
And then suddenly people are making a connection to this cloud. And that's amazing what that unlocks in people, the ability to connect to a metaphor.
Yeah.
So there's hundreds of kind of tools that allow you to do that. And there's some amazing toolkits online now where you can not know these things and you can just search, what is an activity that would help me to solve problems with a group? What is an activity that would help me to get to know a group better?
Mm.
So you don't need to store in your memory all these different ideas. There's just so much online now that can make it easier.
Yeah, and in a way, it's simple. Like I find before I'm starting a board meeting, which the first item is, let's look at the minutes. You know, it's kind of boring. So one of the things that I like to do is at the start, because I chair some boards, one thing I'll do is say, I just want to go every person, not going to take a long time, but what have you brought with you to this meeting? Mm. Like, how are you feeling? And what's one word that summarizes it? And so someone might say, I'm pumped. I'm just excited. I'm ready to go. Mm. And another person might say, I'm a bit deflated, you know, and it just helps us all then to know where we are at.
Yeah.
Like
it gives context for what's going on. And so if someone says, well, actually, my dog just died and I'm feeling terrible, then that might help you to better understand why they're not maybe their usual self.
I
think we also have to be really careful with the questions that we ask and who we ask them. So the one that you just had in there with, how are you feeling?
Mm-hmm.
I'd be really careful who I ask that to. So I'm not going to ask that at a engineering conference.
Right.
Because they'll just go, well, I'm good. So you got to be a bit more crafty with the questions that you ask sometimes.
And I guess it's if you know the people, you know, like in that context,
you've got a relationship already with them.
And it's probably there's permission.
But so important. So in facilitation world, we'd call that checking in.
Sure.
It's just like when you go get a flight.
Yep.
You do the things you need to do to actually board this flight and go.
Mm.
And we need to do the same when we're shifting from one group to another, to another, to another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. So, bring us up to date. What's happening in your world now? Actually, mention the podcast as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, the podcast was inspired by two podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
One was the First Time Facilitator podcast, which is run by someone called Leanne Hughes. She's based in Australia. And then, of course, the other was Seeds podcast, which I'd listened to. And those were the two podcasts that made me go, I could start one of these.
Oh, that's great.
And I think I was about 5 or 6 episodes in when you ran a session online on how to start a podcast.
How to set up a podcast. Yeah, yeah. If people are listening and they want to know, there's a whole page which has all the gear that I use and how to edit and everything. That's encouraging for me, though, to know that it helped in some way.
The seed that was planted. There you go. So I started that podcast just before the lockdowns started. And I was working in a consulting firm, small consulting firm, and we didn't have much budget for learning and development. So I wanted an excuse to be able to interview amazing people and learn from them. So the podcast was my excuse. That was my selfish reason for starting it.
Yep.
And
it's such a good reason to reach out to people, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Would you be on my podcast?
The quality of conversation that you're able to have is quite different as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're able to ask the questions that you might otherwise not be able to ask. And then then there was a commercial reason, which was it's a great way to get your message out.
Yeah.
The podcast was called, I don't know, I've wrapped it up now, so I don't know whether it
is it out there
still present, it's still out there.
People can click and listen.
People can still listen. So the podcast is called Beyond Consultation, and the firm I was working for was all about community engagement and getting beyond just this tick box consultation that can happen.
Well, in the show notes, we'll put a link to it, and maybe you'll get a little lift of
listeners. I expect to see a huge lift. Yeah, yeah. I have no idea what the numbers are doing now. Yeah. I don't know about you, but the numbers didn't motivate me. Things that motivated were the stories that would come from people who'd listened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if you do podcasting for the numbers, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Because someone out there is always going to have more numbers than you. And the reality is, it's maybe a cliche, but it's about the impact that you have. Like, you're telling me that I had a part to play in your starting a podcast that then got 70 episodes. Like, that feels really encouraging.
Yeah.
And I interviewed a guy who had terminal brain cancer. He died 3 months after we'd done the interview. Mm. His son wrote to me and said, thank you for recording my father's voice because now we can play it for his unborn grandchildren.
Yeah.
So, like, you can't measure it in the number of clicks. Like, that impact in its own has fueled me for years.
Mm.
So, yeah, I definitely agree. It's not just about the numbers.
I'd get the odd story where someone would say, I had the worst day at work, and then on the train home, I listened to your episode with blah, 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 and it just totally shifted my perspective. And my audience is very niche. You know, it's for people working in government and community organizations who have a community engagement role. And that was part of what made it work, actually, was I knew who this was for very clearly. And that kept me going through all the admin that you will know about, Stephen.
Yeah, people assume the podcast just magically appeared, but you and I know there's a bit of editing, there's some social media stuff, there's the uploading, there's the copy that goes with the episodes.
Yeah. I think we worked out it was about 8 hours per episode of other stuff.
I think I've gotten mine down not that long. Maybe I'm just being not as thorough anymore. But I can't spend that long.
Yeah.
You know, I'll do this interview, I'll edit it up, I'll get it. We'll take a photo together. Like, that's the image.
Yeah, nice.
And then
job done.
It's done. Yeah, because I've got a number of other things that I've got on. This is just one of my projects. So interesting.
So we wrapped the podcast up because I went out on my own from that consulting firm almost a year ago now.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's been my adventure in the last 11 months is running Paul McGregor. As a practice, as a business, which has been an amazing experience.
Great. Is that what you're continuing to do?
Well, I certainly hope so.
Yeah. So, if people are interested, like, what sort of things are you doing today, or what are you doing? You're coming alongside groups or individuals, or
There's probably three main ways that I help people. One is an inspirational role, so that's speaking and writing. And there I'm trying to get the message out that facilitating is leadership and asking is leadership. So that's what I'm really passionate about teaching people about. So that's one way. And then the second way is as a facilitator. So organizations will bring me in often after there's been a transition point.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going, okay, there's a bit of tension here.
Sure. Or
we're not quite how to work together. And often the value that you add as an outsider is asking what sometimes feel like dumb questions. And actually your dumb questions call out things that they hadn't realized are odd to other people.
Yeah.
And there's immense value in that.
Yeah, I do that quite a lot as well in my role because I come in to support from a legal perspective.
Yeah.
I'll support organizations. But it means I might sit with a board for 4 hours, 5 hours, thinking about their future plans and then what the legal structure should be to support that.
Mm.
And then I'll be asking those silly questions, you know, using quote marks.
Yeah.
And it often unlocks these conversations like, actually, I don't know why we set up it. Why did we set up as an incorporated society? Like,
I don't know. Terry said we should.
Yeah.
That was 18 years ago.
It's just how it's been.
Yeah.
And actually, well, there's other options.
Yeah.
You know, like, you should think about being a charitable trust or a company or whatever. I find it quite fun to open people's eyes. And I told you, I just did this call with Shamabul Yakub today about impact investing.
Mm.
And so that was a really fun thing because I know there was a bunch of people on the call listening who were having their minds like expanded as to what is impact investing? How do we use our funds? What does it mean to look beyond profit motives? You know, like it's really, it's quite enjoyable.
Yeah. I sometimes say that I'm a bit like a head torch. Like, you don't want me on your head all the time, but sometimes the head torch is exactly what you need to uncover something that's been hiding away in a corner.
Yeah.
And you go, ah, okay, it's not as scary as we thought it is over there in the shadows, and that's what has been hiding. It's this maybe obvious thing that we hadn't realized is causing our group to be in a lot of conflict or in a lot of tension.
Yeah.
So that's the second way that I work with groups. And then the third way is as a trainer. So I teach people how to facilitate.
Great. Yeah. Well, if people are interested, we'll put links to things. So just let me know and we can add them in the show notes.
Yeah, nice. Click and yeah, I've find got out a more. Bunch of free things on my website, which might be helpful for people. One is Facilitation Canvas. So that's like a one-page planning tool if you're facilitating a group meeting, a workshop, or an event. And then there's a little quiz on there as well to help you think about what is your preference when you're in a group. My preference is to be the person at the back of the room who sits and observes and sees what's going on. Knowing what your preference is can be quite helpful, because then you can work with that strength, but you can also fill in the gaps around yourself too.
Yeah. So looking back at your life, let's look at your, say, 6-year-old self. And let's look at your, I'm thinking maybe you're about to take on the job at the big law firm. What do you think those versions of yourself, or maybe even in England, you know, 18 years old,
yeah,
what would they think of you today? Like, what would that conversation be? How would you, do you think you could convince them this is where we should head?
Well, the conversation with the 5-year-old, they would probably just ask why a lot.
Yeah.
I know that from my own kids. And the others, I think they'd be quietly pleased that the sort of restlessness within me had found some kind of place. Yeah.
Do you think they'd be surprised that you'd found it?
Yeah, I went and I spoke to our local Toastmasters group last week and just shared some of the similar stories of what I've shared here and now. And someone asked this question that wasn't a question. It was like a statement of where they labeled my decisions as brave and bold. And I sort of went, really? Oh. Like, that surprised me, because to me they just felt like the right thing to do. It was my intuition, my gut, going, something needs to change. This isn't right. So I guess my younger selves would see that I've made those decisions with my gut, and so things feel better.
That's good. Well, I get that sense from you, and I've got a pretty good ability to see if people have found their niche. You know,
is the bell singing, or is it not?
Well, I think it is. Yeah. I think it, I can hear it ringing out, because for me, it took me a while to get to where I am today, where I feel like what I do really, I'm able to be used in a way that is very powerful and I hope helpful for others. But it took me time to get there.
Yeah.
Like, I think sometimes in our lives, we think that, well, when you're 18, you finish high school,
you're meant to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your one word?
You're going to go study at law school and become a lawyer, and that's it. But actually, what we need to do, particularly for those young people, is help them go a bit deeper and think about, well, what is it that will really resonate for you, and how do we help you find what that is? And of course, there's going to be ups and downs, and things won't work, and that will show us, you know, like even in my journey, there's things that haven't worked out that have then shown me, okay, I need to go this way.
Yeah, you learn a lot from those ones.
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm just listening to your story and thinking how it can help our listeners. And one of the things I'm hearing is that, you know, you didn't have a master plan of this is what I'm going to do. You've gone, and now looking to your heart or your gut, as you described it, you know, you're now resonating, the bell is ringing, and it's really encouraging to hear. Yeah. Last question. 5-year-old daughter, what perspective does she bring to your life?
Well, she gives me some of my own medicine, right?
Yeah.
Of the questions. oh, goodness, the questions. Children ask 40,000 questions between the ages of 2 and 5. And so I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. They're right in the thick of that.
Right.
So what I love about spending time with them is seeing things again that you've unseen. I really wish I could think of an interesting example right now, but most of them actually aren't interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's just,
it's
things
a perspective
in your life that are just ordinary, and you, and your daughter at 6:30 at night while you're in the middle of trying to make dinner is asking you about it, and sometimes you curse it, but when I'm able to give it the time and the energy, yeah, that's such a gift that they give you.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Yeah, well, I posted on LinkedIn that I'd been up in Nelson, and then you commented, oh, we missed each other or something.
Yeah.
But that area, the Founders Park, I think it's called, you should take your kids there because it's
we definitely do. Yeah.
It's a nice spot.
Friday night, that's a good spot. So they sometimes have live music and there's a kids' playground.
Yeah.
So they're happy.
Yeah.
In fact, it's one of the few places where the kids can play, the adults can have a drink, and it works.
Interesting.
And we can actually have an adult drink and an adult conversation.
Yeah. That's great. Well, I've really enjoyed our talk. Thank you so much for giving up some of your time and hearing that life story. And I loved the references to the different people, Ali and your friend and you know, your parents, and all of these factors shape who we end up becoming.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved in your case the fact that you've been able to find a path that is allowing you to be the bell, to let it ring out. So I want to encourage you, keep going. And thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Stephen, and for holding space for not just me, but 380-odd other people. That's pretty epic.
Yeah, it's building up now. And I've got a copy of the Apple Tree book, so I will give that to you as well.
Nice.
Thank you.
Kia ora.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that conversation with Paul. For me, there was a bunch of highlights, and that little connection there about the law and what he's done after graduating with a law degree was something that I enjoyed, and I'm glad to see that he's found an area where he can ring the bell, as we talked about. If you enjoyed this episode, then why not check out some of the other episodes in the back catalog? Until next time, kakiteano!